Hello and welcome to the Green Room Golf Course podcast from the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. Thanks for listening to this podcast, which sheds a light upon the golf industry and what it takes to maintain a modern course. I hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody. My name is Jim Croxton. I'm the CEO of Bigger, and I'd like to welcome you to this Continue to Learn Extra webinar. I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Andy Owen, International Technical Sales Manager, and Henry Bechelet, UK Technical Sales Manager for ICL. Today, Andy and Henry will be providing an overview of seaweed products for turf, why they are used, and how they are marketed. Both are very well known, but to recap, Andy is a soil scientist and agronomist with a PhD from the University of Wales. Prior to joining ICL, he was a sports turf lecturer at Myersco College, developing and delivering industry-focused degree-level courses to distance learning and in-college students. Henry has been in the turf industry for over 25 years, possibly well over. He originally trained as an agricultural agronomist, but then joined the turfgrass industry as a trainee agronomist in the early 90s. He spent roughly half his career engaged in independent consultancy and the other half on the commercial side of the industry. Please feel free to ask questions using the chat function that we found at either the top or the bottom of your screen. Ask questions at any point in time. We'll try and get to them at the end of the webinar, and we'll pose those questions on your behalf. So, with no further ado, I'll pass over to Andy and Henry.
Great. Thanks, Jim, and hi, everybody. Good to take this opportunity to present to you all. I think we're going to just dive straight in. As ever, there's a lot to cover, but hopefully plenty here to keep you interested as we talk about this subject of the use of seaweeds in turf. I'm going to narrate and follow through the presentation, and my colleague Henry's going to join and add in as he finds interesting things to say. So hopefully that'll work okay. Henry will just give me a wave, I think, and I can invite him to speak. Great. Let's keep going. So my first slide really just highlights what Henry and I are all about. You know, we're technical staff for ICL, but we have some core values. And, you know, those values are really that we want to make sure we talk about products that perform. We want to make sure that any claims we make about our products are based on research, hopefully extensive research. And of course, we want to be progressive and responsible with our advice. And, you know, hopefully we share those core values with everybody listening today. We're talking today about seaweeds for turf. And I'm going to ask Henry, do you want to make a comment in there?
I said I wouldn't interrupt Andy because we've got loads to go through. But obviously, I've just ruined that in the first slide. But yeah, these values are really important. And, you know, in seaweeds, you know, it is an area where lots of claims are made and maybe not based on extensive research. So, it's, you know, it's quite pertinent that we sort of have these values, isn't it?
Thanks. That's good. We've got an interesting place to start, actually. And I want to start with some survey results. This came from a survey of golf course managers that was run last year. And we put the question to them as of which products or techniques that they use, do they think they'll increase in use for the next 5 years or decrease in use for the next 5 years? And the results were quite stark that came back. Presented there for you on the screen, and there was a large proportion that said they potentially wanted to increase the use of biostimulants and organic products and wetting agents and decrease the use of fungicides. And I don't know whether that's the same for everybody listening today, but it certainly is an interesting sort of thought. And again, I'd ask Henry, what do you think about that, Henry?
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? This was a survey of golf course managers in the UK and Ireland. It was quite an extensive survey. It was one of those ones where you sort of fill it in, loads and loads of questions on different areas. And over 100, I think it was over 125 or something, respondents. So it's a real nice sample. And there's a real strength of feeling about this. And what I really like about this this slide and this question is that it's aspirational, isn't it? It's kind of, it almost gives a view of kind of what the course managers wanted the next 5 years to be like, or what how they wanted their greenkeeping to be in the next 5 years. And then, and you know, and so you, it's not a surprise that you sort of got some of these results. But it's almost like, you know, what you, I suppose, as course managers want to use more of course. And, you know, the problem that we've got with any kind of aspiration, I think, is that they're sort of maybe open to, not abuse, but sort of maybe your sort of critical threshold on things that you want to happen isn't sort of necessarily as high as in other areas. And I think maybe this is an area with, certainly with biostimulants and organic products, that you know, could be taken advantage of, that if people are just saying the things that you want to hear, that you might be more likely to be persuaded to use this stuff, rather than if you're on a different product category, you might have a lot higher benchmark of sort of information required for you to sort of change your mind or to adopt something. So, yeah, I think it's dead interesting, certainly. And, but maybe, sort of maybe open to abuse, I'm not sure.
Thanks. Obviously biostimulants are the top category there, and we would class seaweed as a biostimulant product. So where do they fit in terms of what we do? You know, it's interesting to go back to basics, to think about producing a really good quality piece of turf. And to produce a really good quality piece of turf for use in sports, well, we need to start with good genetics, and we need to make sure we're utilising, you know, obviously the right species, but the right cultivars of that species as well to give us the best performance. If that grass is going to thrive, then obviously it needs to be in adequate amount of light and in full air availability so that it can photosynthesize to produce energy, and then it can use that energy with oxygen for the cells to respire and for the plant to function. Every species has a preferred temperature range. Ideally, we're operating within that temperature range, else we'll start to get problems. And hopefully it's growing in a supportive soil or professional root zone. And often for golf greens and sports pitches, we're talking about sand dominant root zones, particularly so that we can transmit water from the surface out when there's excess water being applied or excess rainfall, but also to hopefully supply some water up from underneath to keep the plant functioning and healthy during drier conditions. Of course, added to all those things are, or is, the supply of nutrients, both the macro and micronutrients, you know, the essential nutrients at the amounts they're needed in the turf. And, you know, really, this is what ICL are about, you know, supplying good quality nutrition so that we can keep the plant healthy and functioning. And I'll stop there for a second, because really, if we get all those things right, the plant should be healthy and shouldn't really need any more. But the problem is, you know, with managing turf, we put our surfaces under stress, often through maintenance and cutting heights, through use, through wear, and sometimes we're operating in environmental conditions, maybe high temperatures or low temperatures, or perhaps with a deficit of water where the surface becomes stressed. And it is in these situations that the application of biostimulants can be useful. And of course, seaweed is one biostimulant that is widely used. Seaweeds have been used for a long time in the industry. And obviously, you know, Jim Arthur, there's my edition of Practical Greenkeeping there, which is fairly well read, you know, said in this, that, you know, we've been using seaweeds for over a century. And we've been aware of the benefits of seaweed for a long time. I don't know if you want to comment on that, Henry.
Yeah, it's in the blood, isn't it? You know, it's one of those ones that goes right back to the very beginnings, doesn't it? And I think, you know, that sort of feeds into maybe people's aspirations as well in some way. But I really love this quote because I think it does sum it up totally. He says that seaweeds have a useful, if not dramatic, effect in stimulating root growth and improving plant health. And so even then, you know, Jim is sort of saying that, you know, sort of, that they're useful, but don't expect miracle. Not wanting to put words into his mouth, but even then, you know, sort of, and you'd sort of say that, you know, the traditional sort of greenkeepers would maybe even use more of this stuff, but Jim's sort of saying, yeah, you know, definitely of use. But yeah, not dramatic.
And so seaweeds are commonly used in the golf industry. Another poll that we ran showed that 96% of the people we spoke to confirmed that they use seaweed products as part of their management program. So really widespread. And you know, when we drilled that down and asked course managers what they expected to see or get from their seaweed applications, you know, giving them a list of options, they very much picked out that they would expect the seaweed applications to improve stress tolerance and improve rooting as the two biggest characteristics there that they would like to see. But do seaweeds improve stress tolerance? Do they improve rooting? And first thing we've got to consider is what research has been done in this area. And we can shift over to that. There is a really good paper. Hopefully you can see the reference at the bottom there. That is a paper by Kahn in the Journal of Plant Growth Regulation. And this is a review paper on the effect of seaweeds on plants. And, you know, really does cover the subject in a lot of detail. You know, and it splits up into categories of what was the effect and what is the mechanism from the seaweed application providing that effect. You know, it talks about growth responses. It talks about managing biological stresses, so pathogens and resistance to pests. It talks about abiotic stress resistance, so the more environmental problems, you know, like drought or salinity. It talks about the below ground interactions, suppression of soil-borne diseases or, you know, soil pests. And then also talks about how seaweeds can promote plant growth promoting rhizobacter. So the PGPRs that will be present in the plant's root zone and supplying or helping that plant to thrive. And it talks a little bit as well about root architecture and things like that. It's a really good paper, and it is a review paper, and there are one or two issues with it. I'd recommend that anyone interested would read it. But, you know, the issues are, well, one, most of that work has been done on agricultural crops. There's some work in there on turf, but, you know, can we say it's the same across the different crop types? And two, being a review paper, it is... sometimes a little frustrating because it's reviewing published literature, which is always quite positive. That's why it's been published. And it can at times be vague. So you don't get a sense of numbers of applications or types of seaweed used or rates of seaweed to provide these responses. And if you just take it as read that your seaweed is going to give you all these responses, you know, you would be mistaken. You know, I don't think there's any one product on the market that would provide all these responses to a plant. There's a lot of depends and ifs in there, which we want to explore a little bit further.
Yeah, I mean, Andy, obviously I want all of those things, you know, we obviously, with our values, we wouldn't be saying any of that unless we have evidence to prove it. But, you know, it does happen quite a lot within the industry that people do extend findings from unrelated crops and, you know, start making promises about responses on turf. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And there's still a lot of unknowns and, you know, there's a lot of positive news in there, but we can't necessarily think we're always going to get those responses from our applications.
Yeah.
So we look at that paper a little bit further and say, well, what is it in a seaweed that makes a useful turf biostimulant? And there's a number of component parts. Actually, it's quite complicated, but seaweed extracts or seaweeds can be a source or are a source of macro and micronutrition. You know, they contain amino acids, particularly the betaines and proline, which help, you know, improving abiotic stress resistance or, you know, adjusting the osmotic potential in plant cells. They contain a range of polysaccharides, you know, complex sugars, if you like, which are quite unique to seaweeds. And these also can have an effect on plants when they're applied. There are definitely plant hormones there, auxins, cytokinins, important in plant growth and development, and, you know, a range of lipids or sterile materials, which potentially are important for things like membrane integrity and how nutrients and other components transfer across and into roots and across cell membranes. So there's a lot going on in the seaweed.
There's a potentially a lot of active biochemistry in there. And again, this is kind of what happens, isn't it? In sort of literature and stuff like that, is people will say that there's, betaines in there and stuff like that, and then extend a finding about betaines on a completely unrelated situation and start sort of saying that you'll get this response out of it. But it is true to say there is a lot of biochemistry, potential biochemistry in seaweed extracts, isn't there?
Yeah. And of course, there is the issue that people never talk about. It's in the seaweed. It needs to be removed from the seaweed into the extracts, and then it needs to go from the extract into the turf plant. And there's a couple of steps there that, you know, are not necessarily always successful. So despite having this range of bioactive molecules, you know, we have to be aware that seaweeds can have a direct effect on the plant, or potentially an indirect influence, in that you can apply to the plant and the molecule gets taken up and it forces a change or a functional change within the plant, but it could be equally, you know, applied to the soil around a plant and affect the microbiology of that soil, which then causes an effect in the plant. And so, you know, there are direct and indirect influences, and it's really difficult to separate out one from the other.
And that was in Jim Arthur's quote, wasn't it? You know, sort of the sort of not dramatic effect on the plant and the soil. He was saying that.
Yeah, exactly right. So that comes to the next thing that I think you've gathered from the points we've made. There are lots of seaweed products out there, but we have to understand that they're not all the same. Okay, there's a range of commercial products available, and these are going to vary depending on the sea plant variety, which will be growing in different environments, depending on how those plants are harvested, depending on how then that plant is extracted to provide the solution we put into the turf. And then, of course, seaweeds rarely sit in a bottle on their own. There are additional components which will play a part also. So I'm going to run through those one at a time, just add a little bit more content to them. So the first step, seaweeds, there's a variety of seaweeds available on the market that have different growing environments. You know, I've listed four there, each of which are available as a commercial seaweed extract for use in turf grass. I think it's fair to say that the top one, the Ascophyllum nodosum, which is the sort of North Atlantic brown seaweed, is the most common and has the most research for, but the others are there, and you know, there are bits and pieces of research for those, and the products are available on the shelf. So it's difficult to decide the benefits between these seaweed types. And we can look to the literature, and there are little bits and pieces we can pull out. Now, there's quite a complex paper. This one here, Wally et al., again from the Journal of Plant Growth Regulation. And this table's a bit off-putting, I think, to start with, but it is quite interesting. Effectively, what we have here are a range of seaweed types. Okay, ANE is Ascophyllum nodosum extract. coming from a range of different locations, Canada, French, Ireland, you know, all those places. And then we have other seaweeds, Eclonia, Macrocystis, Stavilia, Sargassum, which are all commercially available seaweeds. They've been taken off the shelf. They've been analyzed for the amount of plant growth regulator in them. So auxins, cytokinins, and abscisic acid and its metabolites. And, you know, we don't have to look too much at the detail, but essentially it shows that there is a difference between these seaweeds. You know, we can compare potentially what is in this Canadian Ascophyllum nodosum with this North Pacific Macrocystis. We can see there are varying amounts of these plant growth regulators. Now, if we're saying plant growth regulators are important for a benefit in the turf plant, then your selection of seaweed is also important because there will be a difference. Okay, and I don't think I need to say more about that. You know, that's there again in a lot more detail in that paper.
Yeah, okay. I mean, there's clearly differences in the extraction.
Yeah, yeah, and the seaweed type. Yeah, so what is present there?
Okay.
So then we move on. We think about harvest methods. There's a number of harvest methods employed. Often seaweeds are very sustainably harvested, basically cut from open water, you know, where we literally harvest seaweed at the same age from stands of growing seaweed. But equally, they can be extracted from basically seaweed collected off the beach, what is washed up on a regular basis, or, you know, they can be extracted from essentially what is a commercial enterprise to remove weeds from harbours and things like that. I've seen all these three on the market. And that's going to make a difference. You know, it will certainly affect how consistent a seaweed product might be, because there could be varying amounts of seaweed types or the age of different seaweeds or contaminants within there. So there's a difference depending on the harvest method.
Yeah, Andy, we did have a question already on the chat room. I don't want to derail your flow or anything like that, but the question was, you know, we use a lot of seaweeds. You know, is there a danger that we're using them unsustainably, that we're depleting stock? So do you have a sort of comment to make on that?
That's a good one. I think if you're using seaweeds from a responsible company who are maybe sustainably collecting from the sea, they want to make sure that they never run out. And this process of collecting from open water, so the cutting growth of seaweeds, they're not removing the seaweed completely, they're just cutting the tops off it and collecting it, and then they're rotating around a series of stands which are available, so they're treating it very much like a crop. So I think in that regard, you would hope that that is sustainable going forward, and there isn't an issue of, you know, removing this resource from the ocean.
Yes, yes, it's a sustainable industry, I think.
Yeah, in the most part, I think.
Yeah.
So we then come to one of the biggies, which is the extraction method. And there's quite a bit discussed about different extraction methods. But one or two key things are important to remember. Okay, the first is that if you extract in a different way, you pull different components out of the seaweed. And in front of you on this slide, you have the same seaweed, the same amount of seaweed extracted in three different ways. Okay, and you can clearly see that those extractions have pulled different components from the seaweed out because they're different color, and they're different transparencies, if you like. You know, the light is flowing through them in a different way. Now, that gives you a visual representation of what's going on. Of course, there's a complicated step to take if we want to work out exactly what is in those extracts. Now, it can be done, but the chemical methods are complicated. We use an instrument called an NMR, which is a nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy process. And that essentially gives us a peak for every single molecule or compound that is present in the extract. And the size of the peak is related to the amount. Okay, and this work just shows in a snapshot, if you like, that different extractions, an alkaline extraction versus a cold extract, provide you with a different footprint or profile or fingerprint of elements or compounds that are present, okay, as part of the extraction process. So, you know, different components in there, it will make a difference to how the turf plant responds. And we can come through to this other paper here in ACTA Horticulture, which looks at Ascophyllum nodosum and looks at different extracts of that product. It does hot and cold extractions, and it effectively says that a high temperature extract provides greater levels of antioxidants. Okay, those greater levels of antioxidants confer a benefit to the plant in abiotic stress conditions. Okay, the experimental work was carried through, but the key point there is that the work demonstrated there's a significant level of specificity to extraction type. Okay, paper also mentions that the cooler extracts were slightly better in abiotic stress situations, so helping the plant benefit over some pathogen, some disease pests. Okay, so that moves on to another thing when we talk about extracts, and it's this conversation about how you determine or compare between seaweeds, and it's a difficult thing to do. I want to illustrate with this figure that we can have a starting volume of seaweed, and we can extract it in a particular way, and that will give us an amount of seaweed concentrate. Okay, but there would be nothing stopping a company from using the same extraction, the same starting volume of seaweed, but producing a much smaller amount of concentrate. It's just the volume of the extracting solution. Yet if we then sell onto the market something that says 20% seaweed extract, well, obviously, hopefully you can see that depending on whether we take 20% of that or 20% of that gives us a difference. But in reality, comparing between seaweeds by what's on the label is not very productive. It's a better way to compare the percentage seaweed solids, okay, than the amount of extract. But in reality, we still need information on what the product will do. So we need to look to the data. And then this was the last point I'm making here when we need to look to the data is seaweeds are rarely applied on their own. We have additional components in the spray tank or in the formulation. And because seaweeds are combined with additional components, you know, how can we really tell if there's a turf response from the seaweed? Or is it a response, a color response from the iron it's mixed with, or a growth response from the urea that's in there as well? So again, we need to consider trial data to determine whether, you know, the seaweed is useful. And so that moves us on to the second part of the presentation, which is really this consideration of trial data. Now, ICL take trial work, it's an important part of what we do. And, you know, we've linked up with the Royal Holloway University. We're sponsoring a PhD there looking at the effects of soil biology, looking at the effects of seaweeds on soil biology. And some of you will have heard Tamsin speak. She's spoken for us a few times. She's spoken at VTME, continue to learn the last couple of years. She's hoping to speak there again next year, assuming that everything's fine with that, and give updates to the industry about her work. But there's some really interesting and important stuff going on in this research. And let's pick a few bits out. You know, the first, this benefit that everybody talks about seaweeds, you know, do seaweeds improve plant rooting? It's quite easy to assess, you know, and here's some trial work that was done by the Royal Holloway University, done by Tamsin, where, you know, we looked at pot-based experiment in a glass house, looked at three different species, looked at a range of rates from no seaweed to double label rate applications. Plenty of replication to say something sensible about it, just using the seaweed. So not a commercial product off the shelf. This is just the seaweed with no additives in. And in this case, the work was on an alkaline extracted seaweed. Okay, and the results showed this. They threw up that Seaweed applications gave no extra shoot mass. Okay, for all three species, we didn't see any increase in shoot growth in the experiment. Okay, but when you extract the roots and see what's going on down there, we see significant differences. Now, when we look at this result, your mind's always, your sort of eyes always drawn to this result here because there's a lot of variability there. But in reality, what you need to do here is you need to compare that result with that result. You then compare your Festuca across there with that one and your Agrostis across there with that one. And in every case, okay, we saw a significant increase in root mass. You know, these are only little pot experiments. You know, the root mass increased from that to that. But hey, that's a significant difference in root growth, which is important. Now, when you take that information out to the field and you look for root mass increase in a mature turf in the field, you still see increases, but it's a little more variable. The variabilities for field trial work are much greater, and measuring rooting is quite problematic in the field. But, you know, we do see it on occasion, and again, we got some good results from this trial which showed increase in rooting, but you don't always see an increase in rooting, particularly for mature grass, for established grass. You'll often see it for new growth and early growth. Germination establishment phase, we get increased rooting for mature grass. You often don't. That's the study to be looking out for. Of course, we've looked at rooting in a lot of detail. Some of it in quite fine detail. There's this great work you can do growing grass in these sleeves. And I did some work myself looking at different extraction types to try and answer that question as to whether you get the same amount of rooting from differently extracted seaweeds. Sleeve experiment, as I said, and if you grow in a sleeve like this, you can digitally analyze the rooting using a piece of software called WinRhizo. Plenty of replication, 4 plants per sieve, 6 replicates of the sleeves, and I had 4 different extraction types and a control. And this work has been submitted to the ETS for publication, so I can't really go through all the details. You shouldn't present too much of research work before it's published. But I can give you a snapshot of what the results looked like. When measured with WinRhizo, this great piece of software that basically scans the rooting and tells you how long your roots are, how many how much root branching you've got, the thickness, the volume of rooting, and all these other interesting parameters. That is what the results look like. Okay, 4 different extractions and the control and the development of rooting through that early phase of a grass plant. This was done with Lolium perenne, and you can clearly see that in this work, the alkaline extraction gave us greater rooting in terms of its length and the number of, or the amount of root branching. When we pick, Henry, yeah.
Well, just on extraction techniques, Andy, again, sorry to interrupt your flow, but I've had a really brilliant question, which I know you're not going to know the answer to. So it's a massive hospital pass. That, yeah, no, great. So do companies sell seaweed products with the extracts derived from different extraction techniques? Are there sort of like blends of different extractions going on?
That is a good question, and that's that a great might question, make isn't it? A good follow-up. As far as I'm aware, that doesn't happen. Generally,
yeah,
companies
so.
Work, you know, in a way they work out an extraction that works well for them, and then they continue with that. But that question leads you on to the thought that maybe you should be selecting different seaweeds for different responses, you know, and looking at the data for that. But it's got to be data-led, not sort of marketing-led in that situation.
Yeah.
But I don't think they do, and that is interesting. Of course, it is.
I've just been told off by Jim for doing this, like asking questions during the presentation.
Yeah,
but so, I'm just going to keep going because they're quite good.
Yeah, we've got a lot to get through, so don't interrupt.
All right, then I'll shut up. Yeah.
When we focus down on a section of this alkaline extraction, here we go. You can see the intensity of the rooting going on there, the extra branching and those root hairs. And if a plant can generate that amount of rooting, it's going to have a much more intimate relationship with its surrounding soil. It's going to have a bigger zone of influence, a bigger rhizosphere. And, you know, it's off the surfaces of the solid components in the soil where that plant, where the most water remains, and where that plant pulls up its nutrition or takes in, you know, the influencing chemicals that it needs. So that is really important. Okay, next question. What about this relationship with biology? And there's an interesting study here, again done with Holloway, thinking about mycorrhizae. Again, growing plants quite simply in small pots, but in this case, with and without a commercial mycorrhizae, and with and without seaweed applied. And I've only really just got hold of this data, so you know, we haven't got too much to say, but the results looked a little bit like this. So this is Lolium perenne rooting and the amount of colonization by mycorrhizae. So a commercial mycorrhizae applied as a powder, you know, to an establishing plant, achieved about 15% of the root colonized by the mycorrhizae. That's a good thing. You know, we want mycorrhizae to colonize our plant roots. By adding in seaweed to that, we nearly doubled the amount of colonization. Okay, which is an interesting result. If you're going to use a commercial mycorrhizae powder, an application of seaweed looks like, and again, this was an alkaline extracted seaweed, but it looks like it will help. But the result that astounded me was that the seaweed on its own gave better root colonization. Now, those grass plants were grown in sand and soil, so there would be spores of mycorrhizae in there, and it looks like that the natural mycorrhizae rather than the added ones can benefit more from the seaweed in that case. And there could even be some antagonism between the commercial mycorrhizae that is added and the natural mycorrhizae that is present. But we haven't got to the bottom of that. It's just one of those really fascinating bits of work that Tamsin's working on currently, and I want to know more. I want to see what's going on there. Okay, keep moving. So we talk about abiotic stress a lot and stress management. Well, there's lots of claims made about seaweeds on this, you know, drought, salinity, temperature. And most of the work is from agricultural crops. So, you know, there's some work on turf as well. There's less work on biotic stresses, so pests and pathogens. But again, there is some, most of it on agricultural crops. And we've done a little bit of work ourselves, you know, and this is only a small snapshot. But if you make seaweed applications to a golf green, which is maintained at a high level, and you then introduce a stress, and in this case it was a drought stress, so you introduce deficit irrigation, the quality of that surface drops quite dramatically. By making seaweed applications before that stress occurred, you can slow down the rate at which that stress affects the turf. So this is for a seaweed extract, an alkaline extraction, you know, but there's a really critical thing to say here, and that is, you know, the seaweed is not, you know, a get out of jail free card. It is still, you know, we're still seeing a dramatic reduction in plant health. And so the critical thing here is the deficit irrigation. That's what's causing the problem. But the seaweed is helping a little bit, but not providing you with a solution against that drop in quality, or a complete solution against that drop in quality. Okay. And I'll keep moving. Okay, so let's also link up back to the Royal Holloway work and this issue of seaweeds against parasitic nematodes. A great trial done on a golf green that was had nematode infection, took cores, split those cores in half, treated half with water, treated half with weekly seaweed applications, and counted the nematodes at the end of the experiment. Okay, focused on the plant parasitic nematode Helicotylenchus, which is an ectoparasitic nematode. The results of the nematode counts were interesting. We got very few of this type, so we'll ignore that. You know, in this PPN here, we seem to show a significant drop in nematode numbers when we applied seaweeds. But we've got huge error bars going on. And of course, we see that variability because nematodes are a biological stress, and that is generally random across an area. And so when we analyze for each core, core 1, core 2, core 3, right up to core 18, we can see that in some cases, nematode numbers were low. But when we put a threshold on of where we might see nematode damage, in every case where nematode numbers were high to start, we saw a significant reduction with the application of seaweed. Okay, and that's that data just teased out a little bit further. Now, that's really important. That's starting to suggest that seaweeds can help mitigate the effects of plant parasitic nematodes. But this work is only for Helicotylincus, okay? And that is an ectoparasitic nematode. So we still need to do the work for Meloida gyni, for the endoparasitic nematode, and check up on the work on that. And I think Tamsin is doing that work now and will be presenting that work, hopefully, at Continue to Learn next year. So we're coming up to the end now. There's another question here. So that is, what about managing sort of autumn disease? You know, this issue with microdocium in the autumn, can seaweeds help with that? Well, of course, we've done lots of work on microdocium and presented that out, how we manage it in an integrated way. And you know, it was interesting. We've obviously looked at seaweeds. And so I just show this graph. This is amount of disease, obviously increasing there, up to a mean of nearly 30% in the control plots. Okay. And if we treated, or we did treat that area with four applications of seaweed through that disease period, we saw this. No difference, okay? So in this case, seaweed applications made during that disease pressure period didn't help with the management of microdocium on their site. There's two things to say there. Maybe this seaweed, which is an alkaline extracted one, was not the best to apply at that time, but potentially, you know, if we'd have made applications through the summer leading up to that disease period, that could have made a difference. And of course, with trial work, you can never get everything you want in there. This was a trial done just through that period. So they're the results that came out. So taking the long way round, the summary would say, okay, first off, seaweed extracts are complicated, okay? There's lots going on in there and how they're extracted, you know, how we apply them, how those components benefit the plant, you know, are complicated to understand. Lots of products on the market, and we cannot expect them all to do the same thing. There is some good supporting research to suggest that, you know, seaweeds can increase plant rooting, especially for that establishing plant. There is supporting research out there for abiotic stress tolerance. If you make the applications before that stress occurring, that can help. But, you know, the key message has got to be that please don't assume that every seaweed product will provide every benefit. We have to look to the research that's done to think about the benefits that we might see. And they will vary from product to product. So, you know, let's come back to our core values that we started with. You know, hopefully, you know, as technical managers, you know, Henry and I talk about products that perform. We are making claims about any seaweeds we might have in our portfolio based on extensive research and being progressive and responsible with our advice. And, you know, take that away with you. You know, seaweeds are not the same, so ask questions of your distributor or your dealer about the seaweed product that you're using and what they can show or prove that that does to the plant and how it helps. Okay, that timing is not too bad. I think Henry's just dropped off the call for the moment, so I'm coming to the end. He's left me to answer the questions on my own, but I want to finish with one last thing, Jim, if I may. And that is, with all this reading I've been doing about seaweeds, I've actually read a lot of information about how seaweeds help human health. And I've actually made a change to my diet. I drink seaweed on a regular basis. And here we have a seaweed solution here. And thanks for listening and cheers.
That's got to be above and beyond your call of duty, Andy, that is, isn't it? Actually tasting the product seems extreme, even for somebody as committed as you are.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. And just in the nick of time, while you die from seaweed inhalation, Henry has returned back to the call. So thank you for that.
What happened there? What happened? Did I miss anything? I saw Andy drinking something.
He's just drunk some kind of seaweed extract to prove that it's the key to all life, I think, is it?
Yeah. He's the real McCoy, isn't he?
Never felt better.
Before we get into the questions, Henry, anything to add?
Yeah, my computer crashed. So I'm a bit fed up. Anyway, Andy, you probably... we landed on time as a result of you sort of being there. So we need to get to some questions, don't we?
We do. I've enjoyed listening to it, but as usual with technical webinars for this industry, understood little. I do have some questions that were sort of submitted earlier, but Henry, do you want to just attack two or three of the ones that we've had submitted?
Yeah, can do. There was another hospital pass for you, Andy. I'm not asking you the easy ones. I'm just picking up the ones that I don't even know what they mean, okay? So there was one about the sort of... spectral kind of, you know, the sort of, you know, whatever you called it. What was it called? I enjoy listening to it.
The nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy trace.
Excellent. So we had a question that says, why NMR over GCMS or LCMS?
Yeah, so they would be other ways of mass spectroscopy to measure the number or the chemistries in a solution, if you like, and I think NMR gives a wider range or a wider spectrum of compounds that are in there. But I'm not a chemist, obviously. We accept this information that comes from the labs. We discuss what is wanted to be done, and they suggest the best way to do it. I would imagine that GCMS particularly would give a useful trace. I'm not sure that
the liquid, what it stands for, don't worry.
Liquid chromatography wouldn't be as effective, or sorry, the gas chromatography, as the mass spectrometry.
Brilliant.
Good question, though.
Yeah, so there was another question that said, can you recommend any good papers on seaweeds and nematodes? And so we're going to have to sort of probably take that offline, but you know, with the work that Tamsin's doing, I'm sure there's kind of loads and loads of stuff that we can point at better in the direction.
There are one or two. I mean, there has been some fairly robust work done on tomatoes and tomato cyst nematode to show that seaweeds have a benefit in that crop. And so I've got those papers, and I'd be happy to share. There's very little published on turf grass and nematodes, and obviously that's why Tamsin's doing the work. But there are one or two. Colin Fleming's published on nematodes and mentioned seaweeds a few times. And you know, my email details are on the screen there. If someone just wants to send me an email, I'll happily package up a couple of references and send them over.
Brilliant. Okay, so we've got a question from Dr. John.
Yeah.
And you know, it was just at the point that my laptop kind of collapsed, because I was going to ask you at the right point at this one, so I'm still fuming about that. You know, a lot of the work that you've kind of shown, Andy, has been sort of either sort of glass house or sort of quite artificial situations, aren't they? And sort of John asked, any results from sand-based root zones in the field? And I was going to sort of say, well, that Spanish result, you know, where you sort of had that, it was a precise example of what Jim Arthur was saying, that sort of non-dramatic effect. That was actually on golf green situation. Yeah.
And we do have some results for there. Obviously, Tamsin is doing field trials all the time in you know, existing golf course root zones, and looking at that. You know, obviously when you're looking at things like rooting, and, you know, chasing, tracking pests down like nematodes. There's a lot of variability, so you have to up your replication. John will know only too well that we move things into the lab to control the variables. And often when we do field trials, you see less of a significant response because of those variables. But there is clear data that seaweeds can help abiotic stress, like that Spanish trial. We've also got work, you know, showing that seaweeds can help benefit, you know, turf colour, turf quality through the season, both in golf and sports pitch settings. So the work has been done, and I've sort of picked out those that are most significant, I suppose. But there are benefits out there and work been done. However, sorry, just to pick up, there is also quite a lot of work that shows no significant differences. And I, you know, in my career, both at the STRI and at Myersco College, we did a range of seaweed-based research projects that showed no benefit, you know. And if you apply seaweeds to a healthy turf that is not suffering from stress, you very often don't see any benefit or any response. And a few students got caught up with that, looking at seaweeds in their dissertations, and they were really scrabbling around for results.
Yeah.
Because the seaweed didn't provide the benefit, but they could see, or they weren't measuring elegantly enough.
Yeah, sometimes it does depend on the experiment design, doesn't it, with the exercise. And I think that's what the point John's making, that, would it happen in sort of the real world? Right, we've got some really good questions, so I'm going to keep going.
Keep going.
Until Jim rugby tackles me from the side, okay? Can you overdo the application of seaweed was one. Can you overdo it? Are there any problems with it?
We generally apply seaweeds at a low rate.
Yeah.
And essentially, you know, and I think a lot of companies have done a dose rate experiments that show where there's an optimum. And, you know, you never want to apply something as over an optimum. But you know, essentially, if you're applying excess, a lot of it, they're just carbon compounds which are feeding the root zone. So I think you'd have to apply an awful lot to overdo seaweeds. But, you know, there is no need to necessarily apply more and more.
Yeah, I would sort of be doubtful. What about the incorporation of sort of granular seaweeds as part of a seedbed kind of not fertilizer, but as part of that seedbed preparation, you know? Is there any work on that?
There's very little that I've seen. Interestingly, one of those research projects I did at Myersco was with a student who looked at that in a lot of detail, and he unfortunately didn't see any benefits. Of course, applying a granular seaweed, you've got to, you know, you would expect to encourage the biology as that seaweed breaks down. It's an organic component in the root zone. But again, you know, if other things are supplied in terms of moisture and nutrition, what benefit are you trying to get? You know, I guess it'd be interesting, more work needed on that.
Yeah, definitely. Right, so I'll keep going. What was the other one?
Feel free to answer one yourself, by the way.
No, honestly. Look, I just listen to every word that you say, Andy, and just kind of think, oh, what a great answer. And whereas I just rattle on like I'm doing now. So, come on, we'll trust you as being the sort of, you know, the fountain of all knowledge. We're getting some good feedback from people saying that they do see benefits to sort of seaweeds. But
good.
We've got a question here, so it says, which is the nub of it, really, Andy? Is every rep. So this is from Ash. Well done, Ash. He's asked the pivotal question. Every rep will say their seaweed product is the best, but is there an industry standard to go by, or can they just chuck everything in?
So. Yeah, that is a good question. There is no industry standard to go by. And so, you know, you can select seaweeds off the shelf, market them and push them out how you would like.
But we are getting new regulations coming in that are going to try and put some kind of, you know, sort of regulation.
So the what's going to happen with those, there are new EU fertiliser regulations coming in, and for the first time, biostimulants are part of that regulation. Now, we can class a seaweed as a biostimulant, and so to be labelled as an EU biostimulant, that seaweed has got to have been shown in independent trials or long-term commercial trials to provide a certain number of benefits. Now, there's actually only four benefits to the biostimulants that you've got to prove, or one of the four you've got to show. But if you can demonstrate those results, then your biostimulant becomes an EU-certified biostimulant and will sit on the market with an EU kite mark. So coming in the future, we'll probably see two tiers of products on the market. Those that have gone through the EU regulations and are proven through trial work to supply a named benefit to a named crop, and those that are pushed onto the market without that work done. And in the end, then the decision is up to the end user, which pile they select from.
Okay, two more questions because we're coming to the end of the time now.
Sure.
And the penultimate one is the one that I wanted to ask you, but it's actually been asked from Ed at Trenton. Hi, yep. Ed, how are you doing? So, is seaweed better applied through the leaf or to the soil, Andy? What are we aiming at when we're spraying it on?
That is a good question.
Cheers.
Most of the trial work we see applies the seaweed to the roots of the plant or to the soil root zone. Okay, that does mean that part of that seaweed is influencing the rhizosphere, which is having an indirect effect on the plant. You obviously can make foliar applications of seaweeds, and you know, we're still examining the difference between foliar and root applications. There are responses to foliar applications. There is a thought that some of the compounds in seaweeds don't enter the leaf very well and aren't very mobile through the plant from the leaf part. But, you know, I'm still looking for research on that. We still need to learn more. My general advice is apply to the soil and let them be taken up that way, because that's where most of the research has been done. Certainly all that increased rooting we're seeing from soil applications, foliar applications.
Great, very good question, Ed. We've got a question from Ian now. They said, we'll call this the last question. Sorry if we've missed out. We maybe have a look through and sort of get handy to answer them all. This one refers to your rather showy demonstration at the end of the presentation. I should say that both myself and Andy both take seaweed supplements on a daily basis. So you can sort of see that we're convinced of the benefits. But this is a good question for you, Andy.
Yeah.
Was the seaweed that you were drinking an alkaline extraction or a cold-pressed one?
It was actually neither.
Oh.
It was a powdered seaweed version, oh, which has been shown to provide some benefits through some independent trials. And so I used a powdered supplement stirred into water. So I'm expecting my internal biology to make use of that.
Yes, your biome will be dancing, won't it, at the moment. And what species of seaweed is it, by the way?
So it's a brown seaweed, a laminarin species, which looks to provide the best benefits for some human health factors that I've spotted. There could be others.
Yeah, I looked at my package and it's bladder rack that apparently I've taken, which kind of makes total sense. Anyway, Jim, save us from this right now. Jump in. And thanks for all your questions. That's been great. Andy, thank you. That has been fantastic. It's been really, really great. And I hope you enjoyed it. But Jim, it's your job to finish up. And Andy, you've got a flick on the slide, haven't you?
Thank you very much, Henry. We were in danger of there being sort of very little Henry nonsense in the overall webinar, but you managed to claw it back at the end. Thank you for thank you for doing my job as question master. You were infinitely more qualified than I to talk about some of the technical aspects of the seaweed product. For details about future continue to learn extra webinars, which may, it sounds like Henry and Andy have already identified at least one or two topics during that webinar that they want to present on in future, so it may include the deadly duo again. Please visit our website. The What's On page has the details of all our continue to learn extra webinars. Thanks, everybody, and good evening.
Thanks, everybody.
The Green Room Golf Course podcast is produced by myself, Carl Hansel, on behalf of the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. For questions, comments and concerns, you can get in touch with me by emailing carl@bigger.co.uk. That's Carl with a K. You can also join the conversation on social media using @greenroombigger. And we've also got a Facebook page where all the latest notices, news releases and information from Bigger can be found. We're also on Instagram using @bigger_HQ. Subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. The more people know about the sports turf industry, the more understanding they will have about the hard work of Bigger members and other greenkeepers. And speaking of Bigger membership, if you're inspired by what you hear to progress your career in greenkeeping, then a major first step is signing up to the association. The opportunities for career development are countless and potentially life-changing, such as volunteer opportunities at major tournaments and educational opportunities across Europe and the USA. Don't forget, if you're a golfer and you've got any questions about anything you hear on the podcast, have a conversation with the greenkeepers at your club. They've got the expertise to explain what's happening at the course and how it fits into the team's long-term vision to improve playability and enjoyment of the facility.